The show is called Shedding Lights. I'm your host, Bird, and I'm here today with Professor of Middle Eastern History, Joel Bainan. Joel, welcome back to Shedding Lights.
Very good to be here with you, Bird.
And you're from the Middle East, aren't you?
Oh, no. No, no.
Where were you born?
Born and bred in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, I didn't know this. You have people that, you have folks that, relatives that live in Israel?
Yes. My family moved to Israel in 1973, and I've lived there probably altogether more than 3 years. And I go back and visit them once or twice a year, but I'm an American.
And you've also, you've been in Egypt. You taught in Egypt for 2 years.
That's right.
At the American University in Cairo, right?
That's right.
And so I consider you to be a pretty authoritative person when it comes to Middle Eastern goings-on.
Well, I thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for your time and sharing with us. You came on last month, and we're talking about the fact that you had just got back from Israel.
That's right.
And you were kind of giving us some observations of stuff you'd seen out there. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm continuing with that. I just wrote, and don't yet know where it's going to be published, a short article about the Jewish settler thrust in East Jerusalem. People may remember that back last spring, President Barack Obama gave a speech and followed it up with several other speeches and a speech by Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, saying that in order for negotiations to resume between Israel and the Palestinians, the Israelis should institute a total freeze on settlement activity. No new settlements, no expansion of existing settlements, no nothing. And Secretary of State Clinton was particularly forceful about that. And all during the rest of the spring and the summer and the early fall, the Israelis were basically giving the finger to the President of the United States and his policy. He said, no, no way, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. And eventually, folks in Israel told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, that's not a good idea. The United States is our main supporter in the world, and they give us nearly $3 billion a year in aid, and they veto all sorts of resolutions in the Security Council that criticize us. We shouldn't make President Obama look bad. So Prime Minister Netanyahu came up with this clever idea and said, well, okay, we will declare a pause on new settlement activity for 10 months, but we've got 3,000 housing units in the West Bank where the foundation is already poured. We're going to go ahead with those. We're not going to stop constructing schools or synagogues or community buildings in the West Bank. We're going to go ahead with those. And we're not going to have any freeze whatsoever in East Jerusalem, which is part of the united and eternal capital of Israel and the Jewish people. And nobody tells us what to do here. So East Jerusalem, formerly ruled by Jordan between 1949 and 1967 when Israel occupied it, East Jerusalem has got about half of all the settlers in the West Bank, 200,000 Jewish settlers in Jewish-only neighborhoods surrounding the Old City of Jerusalem and in the Jewish quarter of the Old City itself. And these guys are going gangbusters. They are continuing to expropriate houses, to buy land for new housing construction. And between August and just a few weeks ago, three Palestinian families in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah were chucked out of their homes and settlers took them over. And the really interesting thing about this is that a huge amount of this activity is funded by a Jewish American bingo and gambling magnate, a retired doctor called Irving Moskowitz, who lives now in Florida, but his bingo business is in Southern California.
Hmm. Now, Joel, just for the sake of anybody who's heard that word settlements, and doesn't really have a handle on, and sometimes I get a little confused too. And you mentioned that three Palestinian families were put out of their houses. Does that mean a Jewish family moved in?
It certainly does.
Now, how does that work in Israel? Are people just allowed to come out? Come over and go, hey, you don't live here anymore, see you later, bye, take it easy.
No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And settlement, if we're talking about Jerusalem, isn't the right descriptive word, although technically and legally it's the right word. Settlements like sounds like you're out there on the frontier, and a lot of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are something like that, although there are also four or five of them which are major urban or suburban residential areas by now. But in East Jerusalem, what we're talking about is either building an entirely new all-Jewish neighborhood with complete infrastructure, water, sewage, electricity, the whole works, and only Jews can live there.
Is this from land that was previously unoccupied, or was there something on it?
In these cases, typically, the land was not occupied. In 1967, Jerusalem was still a relatively small city, and there were large stretches of land between different neighborhoods. And what the Israelis decided to do strategically was to encircle the Arab city with Jewish neighborhoods so that if there would ever be negotiations with Jordan, it was imagined then that if there would be negotiations, it would be with Jordan. Now, if there are going to be negotiations, it would be with some Palestinian party. But the idea was they'll set up a geographic and demographic situation in which it will be virtually impossible to return East Jerusalem to any Arab party.
And where do the Palestinians go when they get put out like that?
Well, in the case of the three families from Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood on the northern edge of East Jerusalem, they are living now, as we speak, in tents in front of their former homes. The story there is that Palestinian refugees from 1948 were settled in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in 1956 as a result of an agreement between the United Nations and the Jordanian government. So 56 families moved in there, and by now they're hundreds of people. And after 1967, two Jewish organizations showed up and said, hey, we have a deed to these houses from the late Ottoman period, from 1875. So we own these houses, and you Palestinians should get out. Thank you very much. So there was a huge, huge court struggle, and the Palestinians' lawyer agreed to an out-of-court settlement which gave the Palestinian families the status of protected tenants. Now, what that means is that as long as they pay the rent, they can't be chucked out. Because they didn't think that they could actually win the case that they had the legal title to the property. In the meantime, another Palestinian guy shows up, and after this out-of-court settlement was approved, says, look, I have a tax document from 1927 that proves that my family paid real estate tax on this house. So if we paid real estate tax on the house, then we owned it, not these two Jewish committees. But the Israeli courts didn't want to hear about that. And so eventually, these three families were chucked out. And the next day, Jewish settlers moved into their former homes. And the families are out on the street with their furniture and with their kids and their kids' toys and everything, living in these tents.
And these are the refugee camps we hear about that are...
No, these are not refugees living in camps. They are refugees from 1948, but they didn't live in a refugee camp. They lived in proper houses in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, which were rented for them as a result of an agreement between the Jordanian government and the United Nations. Now, few miles north of Sheikh Jarrah, on the road to Ramallah, is an actual refugee camp, Qalandia, for example. There are lots of them all around the West Bank. And there, people came after 1948, and there was absolutely nothing. And the American Friends Service Committee, in collaboration with the United Nations, basically set up tents for them, and then eventually tin shacks, and then a little bit later, cement buildings. So that's a whole different story than refugees who were settled in places like East Jerusalem or in some other regular inhabited area in the West Bank.
So where does a typical Palestinian family go when they're put out of their house now in East Jerusalem? You said they go out on the street. Do they end up living homeless on the street?
Well, they're not exactly homeless because they are in front of their home. And since August, there have been a good number of demonstrations, because this is pretty outrageous what you threw the people out of their homes in 1948, and then they finally got someplace to live in 1956, and then you come back again in 2009 and chuck them out again. So there have been weekly demonstrations every Friday in which Jewish Israelis, internationals, and Palestinians have a rally in a park across the street from the neighborhood where these evictions have happened. The Israeli police don't allow them to have a march. In the beginning, when the demonstrations were small, if you have a march with less than 50 people, you don't need a permit. So the Jewish Israelis would gather in West Jerusalem, which is was always the Israeli side of the city since 48, and they march to East Jerusalem, to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and they'd be joined by Palestinians and others. But now they can't do that because the demonstrations are too big. So the police are really pissed off and have tried to argue that they needed a permit anyway. And since January, have been arresting and beating people and keeping them in jail until Saturday night, because Friday afternoon is when the Sabbath begins, and courts don't work on the Sabbath. So if you are arrested at 2 or 3 o'clock afternoon on Friday, there isn't going to be enough time to bring you before a judge and force the police to show cause for your arrest. So you get thrown in jail overnight, and it's only when the Sabbath is finished on Saturday, late afternoon, early evening, that you get brought before a judge. The first time that this happened, this judge said, no, they don't need a permit for this demonstration. The police haven't proved that there's any problem here. Let them loose. And the next week, as a show of support for the right of free speech and freedom of assembly, the demonstration was even bigger. About 350 people showed up, including a lot of really well-known Israeli luminaries, former members of the Knesset, and so on. And that pissed the police off, too. So they arrested another 22 of them and beat them up, and they also had to stay in jail from Friday night till Saturday night. And this has been going on, there's the beginning of some broader consciousness, at least among the Israeli peace forces, that this is a serious problem, what the settlers are up to in East Jerusalem.
Talking to Professor Joel Bainan, professor of Middle Eastern history here at Stanford, and somebody who knows because you've been there. In fact, you just got back, last month?
I came back late December, so I've been back for a while, but I've been following it very closely because I have a lot of close friends in addition to my family there, and we Skype and we're on email, and they send me all the clips from the press, and a lot of the Israeli press is on the internet anyway, so you can follow it pretty much as closely as you want. And then people put the clips of the demonstrations up on YouTube within hours afterwards, so it's almost like you're there.
How's the breakdown going in Israel as far as the general population in favor of this policy and against this policy?
So first we have to begin with the fact that 20% of all the citizens of Israel are not Jews, but are in fact Palestinian Arabs. The Palestinians are divided into three communities, one community that are citizens of Israel, one community that are under Israeli occupation in the West Bank, and a third community that's dispersed throughout the world, including in the United States, but mostly in Arab countries like Jordan. So 20% of the Israeli citizens, the Palestinian Arabs, are totally against this. Historically, maybe another 20% comprised largely but not entirely of modern Orthodox Jews are totally on for the settlement policy, and they are a very significant proportion of the most militant, most aggressive settlers in and around East Jerusalem. They're the ones that Irving Moskowitz has been funding through the Ateret Kohanim organization, the El Ad organization, and through some private construction activities as well. They're about 20% of the Israeli population. Most of that 20%, again, Orthodox, modern Orthodox religious, but also some secularists. Then you've got, historically, among the Jewish population, maybe 10 to 20% who are pretty strongly against this policy. That number has shrunk very dramatically in the last 10 years. A lot of Israeli Jews who considered themselves supporters of a peace of some sort with the Palestinians became very disappointed when the Palestinians didn't accept the offer that Ehud Barak claims he put on the table at the second Camp David summit in July of 2000. Those Israelis were even more disappointed and angry when the Second Intifada broke out. The Second Intifada ultimately involved quite a lot of Palestinian violence and terror, suicide bombs in nightclubs and cafes and restaurants and so on. There was also an enormous amount of Israeli brutality before any of that Palestinian violence.
Just to back up a little bit, what's an intifada?
Intifada means uprising, literally shaking off. So this was a popular uprising among the Palestinians, basically rejecting what the Israelis had proposed at Camp David, but just as much rejecting the leadership of Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority that had led the Palestinian people into the whole process that began at Oslo with the Declaration of Principles that Palestinians, anyway, thought was going to end up with an independent Palestinian state. So the violence, the terror on the Palestinian side really angered a lot of Israelis, who most often didn't stop to realize that the Israeli army had upped the ante before any of the Palestinian terror. There is a report in the Israeli press that in the first 2 weeks of the Intifada, in late September, early October 2000, the Israeli army fired 1,300,000 bullets at demonstrators, the vast majority of whom were unarmed. And it's after that that the Palestinian violence kicked in big time. Now, I don't want to be understood as saying, therefore, it's okay for people to do suicide bombings and kill innocent civilians in cafes and nightclubs and restaurants and so on. No, that's totally not okay. It's immoral, and it's also politically stupid. But and because it was politically stupid, a lot of Israelis who had been active supporters of peace with the Palestinians just went home. And that meant that the right wing, which never supported a peace, was able to win over all the middle, which was probably 40% of the Jewish population, and tell people in a way that was believed, even if it's, in my opinion, not really believable, we have no partner for peace. See, the Palestinians just want to kill us. They don't really want to make peace with us. So even if we really do want to make peace, and even if we really do want to give them part of the West Bank, we can't trust them. They'll be launching missiles at us like Hamas does from the Gaza Strip. And then after the Israeli invasion of Gaza last year, last December and early January of this year, which was a horrific massacre of mostly civilians, opinion in Israel lined up 94% in favor of that. So there's essentially Jewish opinion, of course, because the Arabs, again, are all opposed to it pretty much. So there's almost no Jewish opposition in Israel any longer. And that's why the Jewish presence at these demonstrations in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem is so remarkable and is actually a cause for hope in the future that some Jews are going to get back on board the peace train.
Professor Joel Bainan, professor of Middle Eastern Studies here at Stanford. And you've been studying the subject and checking it out for how long now?
Well, I first became interested in it when I was 16 years old, when I went to Israel for the first time. I was there for 6 months at that time. And I was with a group training to be Zionist youth leaders. And we were studying, we're supposed to be studying Hebrew. But since I had gone to Hebrew school for 12 years and knew it reasonably well at that point, I told the folks who were organizing the program, why don't you let me study Arabic? And they did. So since then, I've been into it in one form or another.
And would you consider yourself biased on the subject? Or you do see both sides because you are Jewish. You have people that live there. And yet you've gotten this perspective about the Palestinian side, too.
You know, I don't like to use the word bias, because when you talk about bias, that assumes that there is someone who can say what's neutral or objective, and anybody who deviates from that is biased, and that's bad. Now, who is going to be the one, or who are going to be the ones who say, well, this position, this point of view is objective or neutral? That's basically the position of God. No human being who's socially engaged is going to be able to disengage and say, well, okay, whatever stake I have in this thing, I'm just going to forget about that and look at it as though I have nothing to do with it. Nobody does that, and nobody would want to do that because you wouldn't really be fully human if you did. So I have a point of view, for sure. When I talk about it, I'm very careful to tell people what my point of view is. And my point of view is that both peoples should live in peace and coexistence and mutual recognition on the basis of equality and share the land. Now, on both sides, there are people who would say that that's unacceptable. There are Jews, both religious and secular, who would say, this is a Jewish land. And we're the only ones who have any right to it. We might let the Arabs live here with us if they behave properly. We might even let them have certain citizenship rights. But this is a Jewish land. And, of course, the religious folks will say, oh, God gave us this land. It says so in the book of Genesis in the Bible. There are Palestinians, on the other hand, who would say, our families have been farming this land for 8, 10, 12 generations. This is our land. This land doesn't belong to European Jews who came here at the end of the 19th century, and it doesn't even belong to Jews who came from Morocco in the 1950s. So we might or might not be willing to let some of them live among us, but this is an Arab land. So I don't accept either of those positions. I don't think land belongs to particular people because of their ethnicity or their religion or any other factor. I think land should be shared among the people who live on it. And the people who live on that land are Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and they have to learn how to share it.
Now, Barack Obama appointed George Mitchell. And George Mitchell, a former politician himself, helped Ireland iron out its long-running conflict to the point where Ireland has been fairly peaceful, as far as I've heard, since he got that agreement, since he helped architect this agreement in Ireland. Now, he's been the Middle East envoy for Barack Obama since just after Barack got in office, right?
That's right.
Do you see any hopeful signs there that George Mitchell can make any progress in that area?
I have to say that when it comes to diplomatic maneuvering and negotiations at the top level like that, I'm not that optimistic. I think George Mitchell has his heart in the right place. I think he's really annoyed with being stiff-armed by the Israelis. But every time he says something, he isn't backed up by the president. And the Israeli government knows that the only thing they really need to pay attention to is what the president of the United States says, and even more importantly, what the president of the United States does. And the fact of the matter is that in the year since Barack Obama came into office, he's said a number of good things, but he hasn't followed through with doing anything about them. So he let the Israelis get away without a settlement freeze, for example. He had Hillary Clinton say after Prime Minister Netanyahu announced the 10-month pause, but nothing in East Jerusalem, that was a great achievement, which was really, it was eyewash. So George Mitchell, for all that he's a good man and for all that he had some really important successes in Northern Ireland, he can only go as far as the president of the United States is willing to back him up, and that hasn't been very far.
Now, in your opinion, what do you think has to happen or has to be done on either side to bring these two sides together so they can just sit down at the table and start talking?
I think the fundamental issue is that very, very few Israelis really imagine the possibility of living with Palestinians on the basis of equality. Some Israelis can imagine living next to and separate from Palestinians, which we here in the United States used to call segregation. So, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak and former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of Israel, who was assassinated by a fanatic right-winger, they would very frequently say that the solution is us here, them there. So us Jews in the state of Israel and them Palestinians in a Palestinian state whose borders we haven't agreed on and which aren't going to be as substantial as the Palestinians want. So even if that could actually be accomplished, we still have the problem that 20% of the citizens of the state of Israel are Palestinian Arabs. Now, they're there, and the Jews live with them, but they're second-class citizens. So even establishing a Palestinian state in the West Bank, even all of the West Bank, which Israel would never agree to at this point, but even if that were to be able to happen, there's still the problem. The Israelis haven't yet, for most of them, there are certainly very important exceptions, but most of them haven't yet wrapped their heads around the idea that there has to be equality in order for there to be peace. And it just isn't going to work if one or the other side says, now, this is our land, we have superior rights, or we have to be sure that the other side can only do A, B, and C because we're scared. Both sides are scared at this point. And Israel, having the fourth or fifth largest military between Morocco and the Philippines, probably has less to be scared of in actuality than the Palestinians. Some people would say it's too late for two states. It's too late for that kind of solution, because the Israeli government and Israeli settlers already control more than half of the land in the West Bank. So even if Israel were to agree to give some of that land back that they now control, they're not going to agree to give the Jewish neighborhoods of East Jerusalem back. They're not going to agree to give the biggest settlements back. And the result of Israel retaining those settlements and the land that they are on and that surrounds them is that the West Bank will be cut up into three or four different cantons, which are barely contiguous and which don't have good communications between them, and the hinterland will be cut off from the Palestinian center in East Jerusalem. So that's not a very viable outcome. So people look at that and say, well, there has to be then one state, one person, one vote, Jews, Arabs, together. Now, I look at this and I say, I can't see how, with the present government in Israel and with the lack of resolve on the part of the government of the United States, and to be fair, President Obama has got a very, very big plate in front of him with the economic crisis and health care and a number of other really serious issues that he's responsible for. But for whatever reasons, the United States government is not fully engaged in this question. So under these circumstances, it's hard to imagine how there's going to be any kind of two-state solution in the foreseeable future. And of course, the longer there isn't a two-state solution, the more difficult it will be to ever have it. But on the other hand, I don't see how you could have a one-state solution in the foreseeable future, because both peoples want their own state. And in the modern world, that's, I would say, unfortunately, how it is. People want to have their state. So I generally don't talk about I'm in favor of one state or two states, because I don't see either of those solutions happening anytime soon. So what I talk about is I'm in favor of both people living together on the basis of equality.
Do you see any kind of relationship, being a resident of California, do you see any kind of relationship between what they refer to now, especially in California, but it's all across the United States, as our immigration problem, and people from mostly from the south of here, from all different countries from the south of here, coming here for work, mostly. They're not, I don't think they're trying to invade the United States. I think they're coming for work because they ran out of work down there. Do you see a relationship between our immigration problem and the problem they have over in Israel and Palestine?
There is actually a very strong relationship that most people probably don't know about. The United States has been building a wall on our southern border with Mexico in order to try to keep people from Mexico and countries further south from crossing the border and entering the United States. The companies that are involved in building that wall are Israeli companies.
Really?
who have been involved in building a wall and a separation barrier between Israel and the Palestinians. Except that unlike the United States, where we are building the wall on the border, the Israelis are building the separation barrier inside the West Bank so that they are effectively annexing about 9 or 10% of the West Bank simply because of where they're putting the separation barrier. So that's a pretty strong and interesting and largely unknown connection between the two situations. But beyond that, even though, yes, there's always some similarity when there are problems with ethnic communities or religious communities not getting along with each other and so on, but the Mexicans and other Latin Americans who come to the United States for work, they don't expect to be setting up a Mexican or Latin American state inside the United States. They are either going to become permanent residents and citizens, and certainly their children will be citizens, and they will, to one degree or another, assimilate. Or they'll be here temporarily and they'll go back home. That's not the case in Israel and Palestine. The Jews who came to Israel beginning in the late 19th century with the modern political Zionist movement always had the intention of setting up a Jewish state in the country. So no people faced with that kind of a situation is going to welcome the immigrant population. Anybody will say, no, excuse me, this is our country. You can't come here and say it's your country and set up an independent state here. If you're being persecuted and if you're a refugee, well, if we can, we might let you come and stay and give you protection, but you can't set up your own country here.
Now, when the original State of Israel was formed by the United Nations in 1948, did it look different than it does today?
Yes, it did, because when the United Nations General Assembly voted to partition what was then the British mandate or colonial possession, essentially, of Palestine into an Arab state and a Jewish state, there were about 1,250,000 Arabs in the country, Muslims and Christians, and about 650,000 Jews in the country. So roughly two-thirds Arab, one-third Jewish. So by normal democratic measures, the place had an Arab majority and could legitimately have been made into an Arab state or an Arab majority state, all of it. But okay, after World War II, mass murder of European Jewry, very extreme and horrible series of events that rightly shocked the conscience of the world. So the international community decided there should be a Jewish state. And then the UN gave 55% of Palestine to the Jews and about 41% of Palestine to the Arabs, with Jerusalem and Bethlehem set aside as a separate internationally administered area. And if you look at the map of the UN partition plan, it makes no sense whatsoever. These are not contiguous areas. It's just crazy. And especially since there were people on both sides, Jews and Arabs, who said, no, we don't accept this. The whole country is ours. If the UN didn't send peacekeeping troops to enforce that resolution, there was no way that it was actually going to be implemented on the ground. Now, to be sure, the majority representative of the Jewish community in Palestine and the Zionist movement said, okay, we accept it. And the vast majority of the Arabs said, no, we don't accept it. So in that moment, it was the Arabs who took the initiative to reject a plan which, had they accepted it then, their condition now would be much, much better than it is.
So they made a kind of a fatal error at that point, huh?
They did, and according to Rashid Khalidi, my colleague at Columbia University, who is probably the foremost historian of Palestine in the 20th century in the United States, his most recent book, The Iron Cage, is a very, very sharp indictment of the Palestinian leadership going back to 1920, and pointing out that they made a number of pretty serious mistakes all along the way, and in contrast to which, the Zionist leadership, even when they had no real intention of accepting a particular plan, they said, okay, yeah, we'll take it, because they didn't want to look in the international community like they were being spoilers. Whereas the Palestinians always said, well, no, we don't accept that. This is our land. The British came here and decided that they were going to make a Jewish national home here. We never accepted that. But the international community wasn't as open to that idea. And Rashid Khalidi is arguing, well, if they had said, okay, we'll take it, even if it hadn't happened, and odds are pretty good that it wouldn't have happened, at least the Palestinians would have looked a lot better than they do now.
And so how does Israel look? Well, you said it was Christians and Muslims made up, what,
1.25 million.
And then the Jews made up
650,000.
And now it's now, completely different, right?
Now you have, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, a total of about 7 million people. No, it's more. It's 8 million. And less than 55% are Jewish. So purely by demographic inertia, in the next decade or two, the Arabs will again be the majority. Whereas in 1949, after the fighting and after Israel had conquered another chunk of Palestine beyond the borders that were allotted to it in the UN Partition Plan, there was, inside the territory of the State of Israel, 89% Jews, 11% Arabs. So, okay, you wanted to have a Jewish state, and there it is, and now you've got it. Now, of course, some 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled or fled and became refugees in order for that to happen. But many Israelis now say we should have been happy with that.
And so looking back on it now, we see that the Palestinians made some mistakes and then boxed themselves in a corner, and then Munich didn't help at all in 1972, right?
That's right. I mean, the Palestinians resorted to tactics which were completely indefensible. Now, to be, I don't know if fair is the right word, but to put that in some context, between 1949 and 1967, the word Palestine simply disappeared from the international agenda. There was no discussion of what to do about the Palestinian refugees after the early 1950s. They were rotting in these refugee camps. The Arab states were exploiting them on the one hand. On the other hand, the refugees didn't want to be resettled in any of the Arab countries because they wanted to go home. Israel wouldn't let them come home, wouldn't let any number of them come home at all. It just wasn't on the international agenda. So after the 1967 war, which, again, didn't have anything to do with Palestine, it was about Egypt and Syria and Israel, and then Jordan joined in, even though they really didn't want to. They were sort of pushed into it. Palestinians are looking at this and saying, well, nobody's talking about us. How are we going to get people to pay attention to us? Well, hijacking airplanes and terrorist attacks gets people to pay attention to you, but then they don't think very well of you.
Definitely. They've definitely got a black eye over the years, and it seems like they, even today, they've been completely marginalized where the world opinion... Well, where is world opinion on the Palestinian-Israeli issue?
Well, this is actually something very interesting. We, here in the United States, get a very distorted sense of what world opinion is, because the United States is Israel's most important international backer. But in Europe, with the exception of Germany, for obvious, complicated reasons, public opinion is very, very critical of Israel and of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and its actual, if not literal, occupation of the Gaza Strip. And so banks have begun to disinvest from Israeli companies that operate in the West Bank or that play a role in Israel's military economy. Universities have begun to ban the sale of Israeli goods in stores that are controlled by student unions. Pension funds have begun to pull their money out of companies that operate in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, this is still a relatively small-scale thing. But compared to where things were 2 or 3 years ago, there is an enormous shift in public opinion. And I think that the single thing which is most responsible for it is Israel's invasion of the Gaza Strip in December 2009, January 2010, because that was an all-out assault on a largely civilian population. The report by Goldstone, the South African Jewish jurist who ran the tribunal for the Bosnia Wars, and who is a Zionist on the board of trustees of the Hebrew University, his daughter lives in Israel, that report says that there is a strong likelihood that Israel committed massive war crimes in that invasion, and Hamas as well, by shooting rockets on unarmed civilian populations, also committed war crimes. But the scale of the report is very, very heavily leans towards criticism of Israel. And the Israeli government has basically stonewalled it essentially accused Richard Goldstone of being an anti-Semite, which is a little bit tough since he's Jewish. Alan Dershowitz, who's one of Israel's leading propagandists in the United States, has said horrible things about Richard Goldstone, who is, after all, a colleague in the legal profession. The United States government rejected the Goldstone report. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton spoke against it. But in Europe, they're horrified. So we don't get the full sense of what international opinion is.
Did Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's reaction to the report surprise you?
I was surprised because the Goldstone report is scrupulously balanced. The original mandate that Goldstone was given was simply investigate whether or not Israel committed war crimes in the Gaza Strip. And he said, no, I won't do that. I'll only do this if my mandate includes investigating Israel and Hamas. Well, this is the right thing to do. I mean, who can complain about somebody who says, okay, on this basis, I'll do it? And as I said, the report does say that Hamas committed war crimes by shooting rockets at unarmed civilian populations. So Goldstone was totally correct procedurally, and there may be some mistakes or inaccuracies in the report. I mean, the thing is 570-something pages long, so yeah, there could be some mistakes in there, but it was a very serious, honest effort. So the President of the United States and the Secretary of State of the United States don't need to say, no, this is worthless, we don't have to take this as just biased and so on. I mean, there were a dozen diplomatic formulations that could have been used that wouldn't have just flat-out trashed Israel over it and said, well, this is a serious document and we need to study it, and, you know, the sorts of diplomatic stuff that people say that doesn't mean very much. But no, they went out of their way to say, nope, totally worthless, not paying any attention to this. And that, of course, gave Israel the green light to stonewall it.
Professor Joel Bainan, professor of Middle Eastern history with family living in Israel. Professor, where do you see yourself going on this issue? It's obviously near and dear to your heart, and you live here in the States, so you kind of have to watch it from afar, but you visit Israel, so it's got to really touch you when you go there. How do you see yourself in the future with this thing? Because it just seems like it's almost an impossible task to get these people to sit down and make peace.
Well, that's not my task, first of all. I'm not a diplomat. I'm not a politician. So I'd really like it if that did happen, but that's not my job. My job is to analyze it, try to figure out what's happening and what happened in the past and how we got from there to here and such like that. And I am probably going to write a book about this. I've never written a full book about Israel and Palestine. I've written one book in which Israel is maybe a third of it, and I've edited a couple of books in which Israel and Palestine, about the first Palestinian uprising in 1987, about the period after the Oslo Agreement until 2005. But I'm thinking that now I will probably write a book about Israel and Palestine. And part of it is going to be about how and why the Palestine Liberation Organization came to embrace the kind of armed struggle that it did, the sorts of things we were talking about before, which I don't have any hesitation about labeling as terrorism. And then another part will be about this joint Jewish-Arab resistance in Jerusalem. I talked only about part of it in Sheikh Jarrah, but there are other places in Jerusalem where similar things are going on. And also in the West Bank, there are a number of villages where every Friday Jews and Palestinians and internationals are demonstrating against the separation barrier that Israel is building. So I want to write something that talks about why what was tried as a mode of Palestinian liberation and as a way of coming to a peace agreement failed, and not so much how what's going on now is going to succeed, because I'm not sure that it will succeed, but I think it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing for Jews and Palestinians to struggle together, to take the same risks, to share in whatever happens, in the hope that whenever it comes, this will be a model for a reasonable way to live in the future.
Now, most Americans aren't really totally informed about this issue unless they've really studied it, and, you know, most Americans don't really have time to go after a subject like this. Where's some places where folks could get information about this, get truthful information that they could, you know it was the real thing?
I think that the best source of information about Palestine and Israel and other issues in the Middle East as well, is the Middle East Research and Information Project. And you can find them on the internet at www.merip, the initials of Middle East Research and Information Project, .org. They publish a quarterly magazine, Middle East Report. Many of the articles are free online. If you want to see the rest of them, you can subscribe to the magazine. And these are usually short articles, so not long academic pieces, but written either by people like myself who have spent a scholarly career studying and writing and reading about these issues, or by exceptionally well-informed journalists who live in the region, have been there for a long time, and know what's up. Not the sorts of people that the New York Times typically sends over to cover the conflict. So that would be my first recommendation, Middle East Research and Information Project, MERIP.org.
Very cool. Professor Joel Baden, I want to thank you for spending time with us today and giving us your insights on this really serious topic, because it's such a touchy issue. You know, people fall down on both sides of this thing, and it stirs up a lot of controversy. I know you yourself are caught in some of that anytime you speak on it, right?
That's true, and it's a great pleasure to be here with you, Bert, and to have this opportunity to talk about it at great length.
Thank you very much. Stay in touch, and you will be coming back on the lunch special in later this month, right?
That's right. February 22nd, we're going to do some more Middle East music.
Looking forward to it.
Me too.
You take care.